Climate change the facts. Uncertainty, Skepticism, and the Climate Issue by Garth W. Paltridge. Garth W. Paltridge is an emeritus professor and honorary research fellow at the Institute of Antarctic and Southern Ocean Studies, University of Tasmania, visiting fellow at the Australian National University, and fellow of the Australian Academy of Science. He is a former chief research scientist with the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization's Division of Atmospheric Research, former CEO of the Antarctic Cooperative Research Center, and the author of The Climate Caper, Facts and Fallacies of Global Warming, published in 2009. The World Meteorological Organization of the United Nations took its first steps towards establishing the World Climate Program in the early 1970s. Among other things, it held an international workshop in Stockholm to define the main scientific problems which needed to be solved before reliable climate forecasting could be possible. The workshop defined quite a number of problems, but focused on just two. The first concerned an inability to simulate the amount and character of clouds in the atmosphere. Clouds are important because they govern the balance between solar heating and infrared cooling of the planet, and thereby are a control of Earth's temperature. The second concerned an inability to forecast the behavior of oceans. Oceans are important because they are the main reservoirs of heat in the climate system. They have internal, more or less random, fluctuations on all sorts of timescales ranging from years through to centuries. These fluctuations cause changes in ocean surface temperature that in turn affect Earth's overall climate. The situation hasn't changed all that much in the decades since. Many of the problems of simulating the behavior of clouds and oceans are still there, along with lots of other problems of lesser moment, and for many of the same reasons as were appreciated at the time. Perhaps the most significant is that climate models must do their calculations at each point of an imaginary grid of points spread evenly around the world at various heights in the atmosphere and depths in the ocean. The calculations are done every hour or so of model time as the model steps forward into its theoretical future. Problems arise because practical constraints on the size of computers ensure that the horizontal distance between model grid points may be as much as a degree or two of latitude or longitude. That is to say, a distance of many tens of kilometers. That sort of distance is much larger than the size of a typical piece of cloud. As a consequence, simulation of clouds requires a fair amount of inspired guesswork as to what might be a suitable average of whatever is going on between the grid points of the model. Even if experimental observations suggest that the models get the averages roughly right for a short-term forecast, there's no guarantee they will get them right for atmospheric conditions several decades into the future. Among other problems, small errors in the numerical modeling of complex processes have a nasty habit of accumulating with time. Again, because of this grid point business, oceanic fluctuations and eddies smaller than the distance between the grid points of a model are unknown to that model. This would not be a problem except that eddies and turbulent fluids can grow larger and larger. A small random eddy in the real ocean can grow and appear out of nowhere as far as a forecasting model is concerned, and make something of a dog's breakfast of the forecast from that time on. All of the above is background to one of the great mysteries of the climate change issue. Virtually all the scientists directly involved in climate prediction are aware of the enormous problems and uncertainties still associated with their product. How then is it that those of them involved in the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, can put their hands on their hearts and maintain there is a 95% probability that human emissions of carbon dioxide, CO2, have caused most of the global warming that has occurred over the last several decades? Bear in mind that the representation of clouds in climate models and of the water vapor, which is intimately involved with cloud formation, is such as to amplify the forecast warming from increasing atmospheric CO2, on average over most of the models, by a factor of about 3. In other words, 2/3 of the forecast rise in temperature derives from this particular model characteristic. Despite what the models are telling us, and perhaps because it is models that are telling us, no scientist close to the problem and in his right mind, when asked a specific question, would say that he is 95% sure that the effect of clouds is to amplify rather than to reduce the warming effect of increasing CO2. If he is not sure that clouds amplify global warming, he cannot be sure that most of the global warming is a result of increasing CO2. Bear in mind, too, that no scientist close to the problem, and in his right mind, when asked this specific question, would say there is only a very small possibility, that is, less than 5%, that internal ocean behavior could be a major cause of the warming over the past half century. He would be particularly careful not to make such a statement now that there has been no significant warming over the most recent 15 or so years. In the mad scurry to find reasons for the pause, and to find reasons for an obvious failure of the models to simulate the pause, suddenly we are hearing that perhaps the heat of global warming is being, quote, hidden in the deep ocean. In other words, we are being told that some internal oceanic fluctuation may have reduced the upward trend in global temperature. It is therefore more than a little strange that we are not hearing from the IPCC, or at any rate not hearing very loudly, that some natural internal fluctuation of the system may have given rise to most of the earlier upward trend. In the light of all this, we have at least to consider the possibility that the scientific establishment behind the global warming issue has been drawn into the trap of seriously overstating the climate problem, or what is much the same thing of seriously understanding the uncertainties associated with the climate problem, in its effort to promote the cause. It is a particularly nasty trap in the context of science, because it risks destroying, perhaps for centuries to come, the unique and hard-won reputation for honesty, which is the basis of society's respect for scientific endeavor. Trading reputational capital for short-term political gain isn't the most sensible way of going about things. The trap was set in the late 1970s when the environmental movement first realized that doing something about global warming would play to quite a number of its social agendas. At much the same time, it became accepted wisdom around the quarters of power that government-funded scientists, that is, most scientists, should be required to obtain a goodly fraction of their funds and salaries from external sources, external anyway to their own particular organization. The scientists in environmental research laboratories, since they are not normally linked to any particular private industry, were forced to seek funds from other government departments. In turn, this forced them to accept the need for advocacy and for the manipulation of public opinion. For that sort of activity, an arm's-length association with the environmental movement would be a union made in heaven. Among other things, it would provide a means by which scientists could distance themselves from responsibility for any public overstatement of the significance of their particular research problem. The trap was partially sprung in climate research when a significant number of the relevant scientists began to enjoy the advocacy business. The enjoyment was based on a considerable increase in funding and employment opportunity. The increase was not so much on the hard science side of things, but rather in the emerging fringe institutes and organizations devoted, at least in part, to selling the message of climatic doom. A new and rewarding research lifestyle emerged, which involved the giving of advice to all types and levels of government, the broadcasting of unchallengeable opinion to the general public, and easy justification for attendance at international conferences. This last in some luxury by normal scientific experience, and at a frequency previously unheard of. Somewhere along the line, it came to be believed by many of the public, and indeed by many of the scientists themselves, that climate researchers were the equivalents of knights on white steeds fighting a great battle against the forces of evil. Evil, among other things, in the shape of, quote, big oil and its supposedly unlimited money. The delusion was more than a little attractive. The trap was fully sprung when many of the world's major national academies of science, the Royal Society in the UK, the National Academy of Sciences in the US, and the Australian Academy of Science, persuaded themselves to issue reports giving support to the conclusions of the IPCC. The reports were touted as national assessments that were supposedly independent of the IPCC and of each other, but of necessity were compiled with the assistance of, and in some cases at the behest of, many of the scientists involved in the IPCC international machinations. In effect, the academies, which are the most prestigious of the institutions of science, formally nailed their colors to the mast of the politically correct. Since that time in 2010-11 or thereabouts, there has been no comfortable way for the scientific community to raise the specter of serious uncertainty about the forecasts of climatic disaster. It can no longer use the environmental movement as a scapegoat if it should turn out that the threat of global warming has no real substance. It can no longer escape prime responsibility if it should turn out in the end that doing something in the name of mitigation of global warming is the costliest scientific mistake ever visited on humanity. The current redirection of global funds in the name of climate change is of the order of $1 billion a day. And in the future, to quote U.S. Senator Everett Dirksen, $1 billion here and $1 billion there, and pretty soon we'll be talking about real money. At the same time, the average man in the street, a sensible chap who these days can smell the signs of an oversold environmental campaign from miles away, is beginning to suspect that it is politics rather than science which is driving the issue. Scientists, most scientists anyway, may be a bit naive, but they are not generally wicked, idiotic, or easily suborned, either by money or by the politically correct. So whatever might be the enjoyment factor associated with supporting officially accepted wisdom, and whatever might be the constraints applied by the scientific powers that be, it is still surprising that the latest IPCC report has been tabled with almost no murmur of discontent from the lower levels of the research establishment. What has happened to the skepticism that is supposedly the lifeblood of scientific inquiry? The answer probably gets back to the uncertainty of it all. The chances of proving in the hard scientific sense, that change of climate over the next century will be large enough to be disastrous are virtually nil. The same uncertainty ensures that the chances of a climate skeptic, or anyone else for that matter, proving the disaster theory to be oversold are also virtually nil. To that extent, there is a level playing field for the two sides of the argument. The problem is that climate research necessarily involves enormous resources and is a game for institutions and organizations. Skepticism is an occupation for individuals. Things being as they are in the climate change arena, skepticism by an individual within the system can be fairly career-limiting. In any event, most individual scientists have a conscience and are reluctant to put their head above the public parapet in order to propound a view of things that is highly uncertain and may indeed be inherently unprovable. There is a broader context to this issue of uncertainty. To the extent that there is such a thing as normal science, it relies upon accurate observations to verify its theories. Accurate is the operative word here. Climate research has to rely on spectacularly inaccurate data for information on Earth's past climate. Even though there are vast amounts of atmospheric and oceanographic data to play with, together with lots of proxy information from tree rings and ice cores and corals and so on, abstracting a coherent story from it all is something of a statistical nightmare. It gives a whole new meaning to the old saying popularized by Mark Twain about, quote, lies, damn lies, and statistics. Suffice it to say that climate science is an example of what Canadian educator Sue McGregor calls, quote, post-normal science, in which, quote, the facts are uncertain, values are in dispute, stakes are high, and decisions are urgent. In such circumstances, it is virtually impossible to avoid subconscious cherry-picking of data to suit the popular theory of the time. Even Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein were not immune from the problem. In their case, they were of sufficient genius and were sufficiently lucky for their theories ultimately to trump the inaccuracy of the observations they had selected. Other scientists are rarely so prescient or so lucky. In the modern era of concern about climate, the problem is compounded by the existence of vastly complex computer forecasting models that can be tuned, again, more or less subconsciously, to yield a desired result. From theory to observation and back again. If we are not very careful, the cherry-picking can go round and round in an endless misleading loop. But the real worry with climate research is that it is on the very edge of what is called postmodern, as opposed to post-normal, science. Postmodern science is a counterpart of the relativist world of postmodern art and design. It is a much more dangerous beast where results are valid only in the context of society's beliefs, and where the very existence of scientific truth can be denied. Postmodern science envisages a sort of political nirvana, in which scientific theory and results can be consciously and legitimately manipulated to suit either the dictates of political correctness or the policies of the government of the day. There is little doubt that some players in the climate game, not a lot, but enough to have severely damaged the reputation of climate scientists in general, have stepped across the boundary into postmodern science. The ClimateGate scandal of 2009, for instance, wherein thousands of emails were leaked, or perhaps hacked, from the climate research unit at the University of East Anglia, showed that certain senior members of the research community were, and presumably still are, quite capable of deliberately selecting data in order to overstate the case for dangerous climate change. The emails showed as well that these senior members were quite happy to discuss ways and means of controlling the research journals so as to deny publication of any material that goes against the orthodox dogma. The ways and means includes the sacking of recalcitrant editors. Whatever the reason, it is indeed vastly more difficult to publish results in climate research journals if they run against the tide of politically correct opinion, which is why most of the skeptic literature on the subject has been forced onto the web, and particularly onto weblogs devoted to the skeptic view of things. This in turn is why the more fanatical believers in disastrous and anthropogenic global warming insist that only peer-reviewed literature should be accepted as an indication of the real state of affairs. They argue that the skeptic blogs should never be taken seriously by, quote, real scientists, and certainly should never be quoted. This is a great pity. Some of the skeptics are extremely productive as far as critical analysis of climate science is concerned. Names like Judith Curry, chair of the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology, Steve McIntyre, a Canadian geologist-statistician, and blogger Willis Eschenbach come to mind. These three in particular provide a balance and maturity in public discussion that puts many players in the global warming movement to shame, and as a consequence, their outreach to the scientifically inclined general public is highly effective. Their output, together with that of other skeptics on the web, is well on the way to becoming a practical and stringent substitute for peer review. Once upon a time, we were led to believe that the road to fame and fortune within science was to produce new ideas that challenged accepted belief. Preferably, these new ideas would lead to tangible benefits for society. But irrespective of the benefit side of things, the practical basis of all research was to be openly skeptical about everything, particularly about one's own theories, and particularly about any new theory that had some vague connection to politically correct ideas of the day. Conscious, deliberate, and obvious skepticism was regarded as essential to maintaining some sort of immunity from the human failing of seeing what one wants to see rather than what is real. Good scientific practice demanded at the very least that one should present the evidence against a new theory at the same time as the evidence for it. It seems that science is not what it used to be. In those parts of it that bear upon the politically correct, skeptics are frowned upon, given nasty names, and ultimately may have their reputations burned at the stake. Certainly in the field of climate change, one could perhaps be forgiven for thinking that advocacy for the cause trumps the need for skepticism on any day of the week. This is no small problem in the grand scheme of things, because the whole issue of climate change has lots to be skeptical about. The take-home message is that there is more than enough uncertainty associated with forecasting climate to allow normal humans to be reasonably hopeful that global warming might not be as bad as is currently touted. Climate scientists, and indeed scientists in general, are not so lucky. Largely, as a consequence of their decision to insulate themselves from skeptical opinion, they have a lot to lose if time should prove them wrong. Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.